Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, if so many members of Congress are saying the sequester is stupid, and that's their word, not mine, then how come it's still going to happen? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 20th of February. Good as always to have you with us. Congress is off this week, back in their districts doing town halls and meet and greets, a little bit of retail politicking, which would ordinarily make this one of those recesses where there was nothing going on, Congress-wise. Except that in a little bit more than a week, the sequester's going to hit. Those big, broad budget cuts that now, all of a sudden, senators and representatives think would do great harm to their states and districts. Virginia Democrat Mark Warner sits on the Senate Budget Committee. Senator, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be back on, Kai.
What's your understanding, sir, of where things stand on this sequester? Is it going to happen?
Well, remember, this was set up to be the most stupid option possible. And I think when the American public realizes that in many cases, under the name of cutting, we're actually going to cost the taxpayers more when we end up having to cancel contracts of volume purchases, just like families when the military goes out and buys 10 tanks instead of one tank, so we get a discount. Because each account will be cut equally, some of these contracts will have to be broken, and the discount that we would receive will end up costing us more than the savings. When you do this across the board without regard to merit, I think the American public will have a definite right to be outraged at all of us from top to bottom for saying, hey, we know we need to cut back spending, but let's do it in a rational way.
Well, then, Senator, I have to ask, what on God's green earth were you guys thinking when you came up with the sequester? Because honestly, it was doomed to failure from the beginning.
Well, the thing was, it was set up around the whole debacle around the debt ceiling in the summer of 2011 with the expectation that the so-called super committee would actually do its job.
How did you guys expect that, though, Senator?
But,
come on.
Well, I have to tell you, as somebody who has laid out and taken the arrows from both sides, we laid out a plan that was kind of Simpson Bowles on steroids, that was the Gang of Six plan, and I think if we could have gotten it to the floor, I think we could have gotten a majority. But there are a lot of folks in Washington that, quite honestly, I'm not sure want to reach the kind of compromise that we've need. And then when we take these kind of half steps, you know, I think we need additional revenue. What happened on New Year's Eve, you know, got us part of that revenue. But if you take the Simpson-Bowles plan under today's baseline, that would have generated $2 trillion of additional new revenue over 10 years. We got $600 billion. Those who say that's the end of revenue, that's just not a rational way to look at the problem.
And yet the president discarded the recommendations of his own Simpson-Bowles committee.
I think there is the idea that there is one party or another that bears all the blame, and this is not true. There's plenty of blame to go around. But when we're talking about something, when this economy, which is so poised to actually take off, the single biggest thing holding back job growth and economic growth is the failure of our political system to at least get our balance sheet right.
Say that again. Do you think people in Washington understand that you guys are the ones holding back this economy?
I think there are people, I am surprised that there are some in Washington who say, well, it just has to get a little bit worse before we get there. That makes no sense to me. I spent for the 20 years in business, if I would have said, you know, we've got to make our product a little bit crummier before we're willing to kind of change around and actually get ahead of our competition, I'd fire somebody like that. Hmm. We are, unfortunately, in that stage right now where I think there's a lot more recognition that we have to do more revenues, we have to reform entitlements, we have to do cutting, but you know, there seems to be a lot more about who's going to win the political argument of the day or the week versus how are we going to make sure we get this economy going? How do we get the literally $2 trillion in private capital sitting on the sidelines looking for a place to invest? And America looks a heck of a lot better than the rest of the world if we can at least say the political system itself is not going to impede that kind of growth.
Senator, always good talking to you, sir.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks
Take
for
care.
Your time. Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia. Meanwhile, on Wall Street today, a long, slow slide. to the sad music. Details, numbers, you know the drill. When you want to get a sense of how American consumers are feeling, Walmart's not a bad barometer. The world's biggest retailer announces fourth quarter profits tomorrow, and they are expected to be pretty good, holiday sales and all that. Next quarter, though, quite possibly less impressive. Bloomberg News got its hands on an internal Walmart memo last week that said sales the first 2 weeks of this month were miserable. The company blames that 2% Social Security payroll tax increase that went into effect at New Year's. True? Marketplace's Jim Burris took a look.
Walmart sales could be a bit lower this month because Kay Jake's shopping cart is a bit emptier. That's because her paycheck is a bit smaller. A
couple of dollars here and there, you know, it does add up.
For the average consumer, about $15 a week or so is eaten up by the return of the full Social Security payroll tax. For Jake's, who shops at this Atlanta Walmart a few times a week, that's real money.
What you're buying, it may be less than perhaps what you come in for. So there is some type of effect.
I don't know. It's still early to make the call, but it does seem to be having some impact.
Analyst Patrick McKeever follows Walmart for MKM Partners. He says the payroll tax increase is just one of several factors that play into retail spending.
But for lower income consumers, you know, it's more of a negative than for middle and upper income consumers.
And guess where a lot of lower income consumers shop? Still, part of Walmart's poor start could actually be because the economy is getting better. Charlie O'Shea is a senior analyst at Moody's. He says we could be seeing a reversal of what's known as the trade down effect.
Someone shopped at store A, and now that they're making less money, they shop at store B. And we saw a lot of that during the recession when Walmart picked up a lot of sales.
O'Shea believes a good number of consumers who traded down in recent years are now returning to store A. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
There's a new report out today from the Pew Charitable Trusts. It's about payday loans, how people use them, and more interestingly, why. They're advertised, those loans are, as quick fixes for unexpected expenses. A couple of $100 just to hold you over till your next paycheck. Pew says the average borrower ends up in debt for 5 months, pays $520 in finance charges for a loan of just $375, and, get this, would do it again. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Tracy Samuelson reports.
Evelyn Hatchett knows way too much about payday loans. She's a retired garbage worker in Houston, and back in 2006, she fell behind on basic bills, her electricity, some car repairs, and she thought if she could just catch up a little bit. But her sister said, don't go down that path.
She got caught up years ago in that system like that, but I said, oh, no, they gonna loan me this money. I'm gonna get it, because it was good at the time.
It seemed simple enough. She'd get $350 now and pay back $425 in a couple of weeks. But she couldn't pay it all back at once, and so she started paying just the finance charges. Then she got a new loan to pay off the old one. Hatchett estimates she's borrowed about $2,000 this way over the years, plus a separate $1,500 against her car. She's probably paid it all back now 3 to 4 times over.
I would go to one company and get some, then I go to another. And I'm saying at a time I had like 5 loans out at one time because that's how desperate I needed the money.
Nick Bork with Pew Charitable Trusts says the study found almost 40% of payday loan borrowers would have taken out a loan no matter what the terms were, that their relationships with these stores are complicated.
They're often talking to people behind the counter who do remember their names, and they look them in the eye and they smile and they're nice to them, and they hand them money when they're in a difficult situation.
Like scratching an itch, it feels good for just a minute. Borrowers say they're grateful to get the money, but then they feel taken advantage of. 75% say they want more regulations on payday lenders. Evelyn Hatchett is still working on her loans. She's down to 2 now, about $700 left to go. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but there is something going on with gas prices. And by going on, I mean going up. 45 cents in the past month. 33 straight days of increases, say the good people at AAA. And yes, oil prices are going up too. But how does it work down at the retail level? Why is one gas station $4 a gallon and the other one down the road, I don't know, 405, 406? So we called the guy we know who runs a gas station. Oz Elam has a place on Boston Post Road in Pelham, New York. Oz, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too.
So, Oz, what's the number right now? What's a gallon of gas going for?
Right now, it's $3.99.
And how did you come up with that number?
I check my wholesale number. I find out my shipment, how much cost going to be. Then I'll make quick ride around the neighborhood. And I check my margin. I add a couple pennies. But we think the $4 is a red line that we shouldn't cross.
Do you actually see people not turning into your gas station because you're charging $4 a gallon instead of $3.99?
$3.99 is definitely much effective than $4.
And how much? What's your margin? Really, just a couple of pennies is your margin?
It is a couple of pennies. We definitely not making money while the gas price is going up.
Well, explain that a little bit, right? Because if I'm paying,
sure.
If I'm paying, you know, $4.30 something out here.
Oh my God! You should have to visit me. Okay.
I would, except it would cost me so much in gas to drive to come see you. If I'm paying $4.30 a gallon, somebody's making some money.
Definitely, everybody blames the market. I think the Wall Street. I know we are not making. I know my wholesaler is not making as much as the people think.
So we've talked about this before, actually. The whole thought of you actually making money on what you sell in the store that's not gas, right? You use gas as a way to get people in the door.
I mean, of course, we do some from the gas, but or major income from the store.
Like Slim Jims and cigarettes and a cup of coffee?
Couple of cups of coffee. Coffee is the main item.
What's your margin on a cup of coffee, Oz?
I never calculated, but definitely not less than 30-40%, not less, maybe more.
Do people complain to you about gas prices when they come in to pay or swipe their credit card? Do they say, you know, it's just $4 is ridiculous?
It is ridiculous. I mean, yeah, definitely.
Yes, but do people complain to you about it?
Yeah, of course, they cannot go to Wall Street or they cannot contact with the wholesaler. As soon as we are the only person they contact with, of course, they complain us.
Yeah. How come when gas prices go up, they go up really fast, but they come down really slowly?
I believe that because of the stocks, value prices goes down, but you want to do is you want to melt what you have in your stock.
Yeah.
We are running some kind of business, and the business, the main purpose of the business is to making money.
Yep.
If you're not making money while your price is going up, you have to make some money somehow. And the other way is while it's going down.
Oz Elam, he runs a gas station in Pelham, New York. It's in Westchester County, just north of New York City. Oz, thanks a bunch.
You're welcome.
Coming up.
There is a growing movement. I don't know how well this would work, but the idea is this: to tax drivers the way they probably should be taxed, which is per mile driven.
Dubner, yeah, I don't think that's going to work so well. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials unloaded 108 points today, 0.75%, finished at 13,927. The NASDAQ deleted 49 points, about 1.5%, ended at 3164. The S&P 500, why it sank 18 points, 1.25%, closed at 1511. The home builder Toll Brothers and GPS maker Garmin each lost more than 9% today after missing expectations. Boeing lifted 0.2% based on two bits of good news. Japanese investigators finally determined why a 787 Dreamliner battery caught fire last month. Turns out it was wired improperly. And Boeing engineers agreed on a new labor contract as well. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slid to 2.01%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for January. Are consumers experiencing inflation in their day-to-day living expenses? The Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index. And it's the anniversary of The New Yorker. The magazine was first published on February 21, 1925. Price, 15 cents. Current price, $6.99. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was word from the College Board today. The SAT is perhaps how you know them best. They said more high school students than ever are taking advanced placement exams. And not only that, those same students are getting better scores, too. But some prestigious colleges have stopped letting students use APs to place out of freshman year or even some required courses, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains.
Alex Brown is a senior at Guilford High School in Connecticut, and she's taking two AP classes, statistics and chemistry.
They're both really intense. I don't think people understand like how much AP classes actually take out of us.
Now, it turns out that despite all of Alex's hard work, some schools won't give her college credit for her scores. Brown won't, Columbia won't, and most recently Dartmouth. Justin Anderson is a spokesman for Dartmouth.
We want a Dartmouth education to take place at Dartmouth.
Translation, APs aren't Dartmouth. Ken Bernstein agrees. He's a retired teacher from Maryland, and he grades some AP exams. He says even though a third of high schoolers are taking AP tests,
there aren't that number of students prepared to function at a college level. Let's be realistic.
Trevor Packer is a vice president at the College Board, which runs the AP tests, and he says the College Board is revamping its exams. But there is no question, he says, that APs are making students more prepared for college.
The research does consistently show that students who participated in AP courses in high school and earned a score of 3 or better perform at a higher level than matched peers.
And even if some top schools aren't giving college credit, AP tests still look good on your transcript. So they may not let you get out of freshman year, but they sure will help you get into college. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
If you drive, there are certain costs you just can't get away from. Gas, obviously, as Oz was telling us earlier. Insurance and parking, too. Depending on where you live, paying for parking is a fact of life. Dealing with meters, scrounging for quarters, or swiping your credit card, getting a ticket when your time runs out. But what if there was a way to skip the meter altogether? Ask and you shall receive, as Shannon Mullen reports.
Portsmouth, New Hampshire is one of those charming New England towns where the busy central square is lined with bookstores, boutiques, and coffee shops, the kinds of places where you like to lose yourself for a while. But it's also lined with parking spaces and hungry meters.
So we're walking down Pleasant Street, and this is one of the busiest parts of town.
Tom Cosciero is head of parking operations here. He says his enforcement officers write an average 170 parking tickets a day. The town has those new kiosks that take credit cards, but drivers here have another option aimed at saving them time, money, and stress. For $20, they can buy a wireless device the size of a credit card called an Easy Park. It works kind of like a stopwatch to track how long a car is parked in a space. Then it charges the driver for only that time.
For the person who's using the device, they come, they park, they walk away. They don't have to worry about putting tickets in their windshield or worry about how much time they need to buy.
Drivers prepay for parking online, so the money goes straight into the city's bank account. Fewer coins to collect. If there's a 2-hour parking limit on a space, you still have to move by then. But taking meters out of the equation means you can let that lunch meeting go longer than you planned without worrying you'll get a ticket. Across the country, more cities are testing technology like this alongside traditional parking meters to see which method prevails. Another way to pay that's catching on is the free smartphone app. There's one called Park Mobile that's available in 32 states. Lorenz Eckelblum is the company's VP of Business Development. He says pay-by-phone technology suits a lot of Americans' new habits.
We don't have a lot of cash with us. The increasing popularity of smartphones in the U.S., there is a huge change and shift in behavior of people.
Washington, D.C. signed on to Park Mobile 2 years ago. Now the district gets more than 40% of its parking revenue through the app.
The beauty of the system is that you can remotely extend your transaction.
In other words, you can add money to your meter without giving up the cozy chair at Starbucks. Eckelblum says the app has over 1 million users, and it's adding more than 50,000 new members a month. Figure in that Park Mobile banks a 35-cent fee per transaction, and there's a monthly membership fee for the Easy Park system Portsmouth uses. So there's big profit potential for the products that win drivers over.
There's lots of competition for the best way to charge people for parking.
Donald Shoup teaches urban planning at UCLA. He says high-tech parking payment systems are widespread in Europe, but Americans are just catching on.
The manufacturers tell me it's a nightmare selling anything to cities in the United States. They're so cautious. They seem to be afraid that the customers won't accept it or won't understand it. But it is changing.
Shoup says the latest technology is making life easier, even for drivers who don't have it. Some cities are collecting data from parking apps and wireless devices to find ways to free up more spaces for everyone. In Portsmouth, New Hampshire, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks we talk to Stephen Dubner. He is the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how you been, man?
Great, Kai. Thank you. Been thinking about you. You drive a lot out there in California, right?
It's L.A., baby. Of course we do. Yeah.
What are you paying for gas these days?
Oh, it's a lot. We were just talking about this earlier in the show. We were talking to our gas station guy. I'm paying like $4.30 and change a gallon.
Okay. So people generally don't like that, even though relatively we pay pretty cheap gas.
Yep.
The good news, however, is MPG, miles per gallon.
Yeah.
We are now at a point where we get more miles per gallon of gas than any time in history, about 24 miles on average for the U.S. car fleet. And that number, because of federal regulations, is going to go up quite a bit in coming years. So great news, right?
Great. Yes. Now what? With you, it's always good news, bad news, dude. What do you got?
Well, let's go a little deeper.
Right.
Fuel economy goes up. It means that the cost of every mile you drive goes down.
Yes.
So people have an incentive to drive more, which can lead to more congestion, more risk of accident. But there's an even less obvious problem than those. Where do we think the money to build and maintain our roads all comes from? Here is Jamie Rawl from the National Conference of State Legislatures.
Okay. And right now, the nation relies extremely heavily on gas taxes for transportation funding, and advancements in fuel efficiency pose some real problems for transportation budgets.
If you follow the logic train here, it's people are using less gas because cars are more efficient, and then there's less tax revenues being raised to pay for the roads, right?
You got it. Revenues are hurting, but it hurts additionally because the gas tax is such a strange tax. Instead of being a percentage of, 2%, 5% per gallon, it's a fixed rate. So the federal rate is 18 cents a gallon. States add their own state taxes on, again, a fixed rate. So because it's fixed, unlike, let's say, a sales tax, you don't raise more tax revenue when the price of gas goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So every year what happens is gas tax revenues lose purchasing power.
All right. So this is one of those got to ask it questions, even though I know the answer. Why not just raise the gas tax?
It would seem logical. Economists have been many economists have been lobbying that for years. But politically, for whatever reason, the gas tax is one of these things that is just a no-go zone.
All right. So find me the Freakonomics way out of this then.
Let's go down a wrong path first, shall we?
Okay.
I hate to pick on politicians, but the governor of Virginia, Robert McDonnell.
Yes.
Has an idea that seems like a pretty bright idea, but most economists would say it's not bright at all. What he wants to do is eliminate the state gas tax in Virginia and make up for those funds by raising the sales tax.
And that's a bad idea because?
Because a tax is most fair when it hits the people who should pay it but leaves everyone else alone, right? But what Governor McDonnell is doing is flipping that logic.
All right, so hit me with your plan.
Well, there is a growing movement. I don't know how well this would work, but the idea is this: to tax drivers the way they probably should be taxed, which is per mile driven. So that way, you'd pay the same amount for the roads whether you're driving, you know, a gas guzzler or an electric car that doesn't use any gas at all. Here's Jamie Rawl again.
At least 18 states have pursued pilot projects. And in the past 5 years, legislatures in at least 11 states have considered more than 20 proposals to establish or study state-level fees of this kind.
Yeah, you know what, though? This smacks of Big Brother watching me when I drive, dude, knowing how where I'm going, right?
People will not like this idea in many cases, I would say. Yeah. On the other hand, let me just say this. We've all gotten used to willingly carrying around a GPS device with us at all times, which is what a smartphone does, right?
Yeah,
we're
true.
Also getting used to the ideas of electronic tolling where we don't have to stop at the booth. So I wouldn't be shocked if we were to see some per-mile taxing in the future. If things get really desperate, if you really need to raise money for roads, we could try what they do in other parts of the world, which is this guy. Traffic fines that are indexed to how much money you actually earn. So in Finland, for instance, if you get a speeding ticket, you are fined about 20% of 1 month's take-home pay.
Wow.
So, you know, the speeding fisherman is going to pay a lot less for his ticket than the speeding high-tech boss or radio talk show host, for that matter.
Yeah, ba-dum-boom. One cautions, though, that this is America, my friend.
That's true. Not yet, Kai. Check in with me in a couple weeks. We'll see if we're all looking a little bit more finished around the ears, okay?
Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
See ya.
Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace is co-produced by WNYC and is supported by Reputation.com, helping make professionals and businesses look their best in search results and online review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a pause to observe a 5-0 vote in the Federal Communications Commission today, a rare moment of unanimity in Washington that could bring good things to a wireless internet connection near you. The FCC voted to set aside more of the wireless spectrum for Wi-Fi. It is not, we should say, a done deal yet. Public comments and a final vote await. And yeah, there are other people using that same chunk of frequencies right now. But at least maybe there is hope that someday your 11-year-old streaming videos at home won't jam up your home Wi-Fi network. Not that I really know anything about that at all. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow unloaded 108 points. That is 0.75%. The NASDAQ deleted 49 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 sank 18 points, 1.25%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.